Hello and welcome to The Ballpark, a podcast from the Phelan US Center here at the London School of Economics. I'm Chris Gilson, managing editor of the Phelan US Center's blog on US politics and policy, USAP. In June 2024, I spoke to Patrianne Smith, professor in the College of Education at the University of South Florida. Dr. Smith's transdisciplinary research considers how literacy teaching, research assessment, and policy are influenced by the intersection of race, language, and immigration. Her work examines how differences in languages, Englishes, and English language ideologies affect Black Caribbean students' immigrant literacy practices as they cross cultures and languages between their home countries and the United States. We spoke about her new book, Black Immigrant Literacies, Intersections of Race, Language, and Culture in the Classroom. Well, Professor Smith, thanks so much for speaking to us on The Ballpark today. It's great to be able to speak to you. I'd just like to start out by asking you if you could please talk about your academic background and your research interests, please. Thank you.
So I studied with my academic background in St. Lucia, where I grew up as a child and really began my journey, I guess, through the educational system. I was primarily homeschooled, but then upon starting my college degree, I moved to Trinidad and Tobago, which is where I did my undergraduate degree in elementary education with a concentration on English language arts and also a minor in English. And so my foundational academic background is steeped in a teacher training sort of orientation. I focused on about 14 subjects that were required for learning how to teach and, you know, creating lesson plans in across the curriculum. And so a lot of my foundational work in teaching comes out of the University of the Southern Caribbean, which was the then Caribbean Union College. I worked in Trinidad as a teacher, worked in St. Lucia as a teacher of elementary school students, and then also supported my friend and mentor, Dr. Hyacinth McDowell, with a reading clinic. At the time, I was really focused on supporting literacy intervention, literacy assessment in the clinic. But then I realized I didn't have sufficient information about what does it mean to teach literacy. I had not done a degree in literacy. And so I was seeking for that really great opportunity to learn more. And that's how I got to the University of South Florida, undertook a master's degree in reading, became a reading specialist, certified reading specialist, meaning that I spent a lot of time with what we think of as traditional literacy practices, phonemic awareness, phonics, comprehension, vocabulary, writing, but all of these based on what we think of as a standardized English norm designed to be what every child should master in what we think of as schools and universities, both in the US and the Caribbean, English-speaking Caribbean at large. And so my PhD then, which I pursued after the master's degree, was quite informative in terms of opening my eyes about how literacy researchers, just a few of them, had started thinking of the impacts of language diversity and literacy diversity in the field. And so I was very fascinated by what it meant or what it would mean to consider how individuals who were in the Caribbean were grappling with literacy, but who were always having to leave parts of themselves behind so that they could demonstrate that they were good enough. In fact, I had spent the majority of my life doing that since I was a kid. I had been very interested in reading. So I had read so much, and all of the books that I had read, I would say that the majority of them were based on white students, students whom I wanted to pattern my life after. I wanted to be like them. They were the students who had all the great things in the books, and they were the students who had all the privileges. At the time, I didn't know that I was doing this, but as I got through the research, I began to see so much of what I had done as a teacher in the Caribbean context was really based on my lens of viewing the world as a European person being better than me. And not even thinking of myself then as at the time as someone racialized as Black, because, you know, what did that matter? You know, these were the people that I needed to pattern my life after. And so I say all of this to say that my coming to the PhD and focusing on literacy, a concentration on literacy, but having a multilingual emphasis, which focused on diversity, gave me the opportunity to see the world of literacy from a very different vantage point, I think, compared to how I had been introduced to it in my master's or how I had seen it as a teacher back in the Caribbean, and really sort of created what I would call a revolutionary pathway for me to embark on what I think of as a redemptiveness, really trying to undo the harm I had done, maybe not to the students that I had done it with, but to other students whose presence I was impacting and to teachers whom I served in my university or continue to serve in my university here at USF. And so my academic background has been sort of, you know, focused on developing, you know, greater understandings of what these diversity pathways mean in literacy. I had gone on to work at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, my first position, and then to Texas Tech University as an assistant professor. And then now coming back to USF after almost 7 to 8 years to serve in my capacity as associate and full professor. I would say that my research interests are then very much geared towards Black immigration, Black immigrant literacies, looking at how race, language, and migration intersect, not just for Black immigrant students, but what does this mean for literacy teaching and research at large?
Thank you so much. And I think that's great context for what we're going to be discussing as well. So thank you so much for that. So my next question is, your most recent book is Black Immigrant Literacies, Intersections of Race, Language, and Culture in the Classroom. Can you give our listeners a brief overview of the book, what it's about, and what led you to write it, please? Thank you.
Sure. So in my book, Black Immigrant Literacies, Intersections of Race, Language, and Culture in the Classroom, I describe and present in detail what I call the authentic narratives or stories of Black immigrant students, two of them specifically from my research, whose stories I thought were quite fascinating, from Jamaica and the Bahamas. They were operating as part of a Caribbean student association where I was the advisor in a Southwestern university, a large Southwestern university. And during the time, I was very immersed in supporting the organization, helping them to get it back on track, helping them to bring other Caribbean students into community, you know, creating opportunities for us to cook Caribbean food, have dances. And of course, this was not an exclusionary organization. We had all kinds of students being part of the camaraderie. We had white students. We had students who are American sometimes joining us. And so we had this opportunity through that organization for me to get to understand what these students' lives were. And I really never started working with them with the book in mind. But as I began to hear their stories and learn about them and function as what I call a scholar, mother, educator, listening to their challenges and them working through things, I realized that this group of students, this particular population of students, was invisible in the US system. Invisible because I had also seen my daughter moving from being a young child to middle school to high school. I had seen sort of how this invisibility, what I called the silenced invisibility in my research, had been manifested. And I had also seen how being an immigrant myself, racialized as Black in the U.S. system, that I too had faced so many challenges around what does it mean to be a Black person in a context where often individuals who are racialized as Black don't see you as belonging to the Black American group, but also individuals who are white see you as a Black person first and then everything else after, particularly given all of the challenges around immigration and how that was becoming quite a bit of a big deal when I first started this work, but also becoming even more exacerbated. And so all of these pieces, I would argue, layers of what it means for race, language, and immigration to intersect, coming out of multiple pathways in my personal and professional experiences, led me to really think about what would it mean to foreground the stories of these Black immigrant students who are often described as international, which I think is just a fancy word to make them sound less immigrant, but which does not necessarily detract from the fact that they are grappling with so much, and particularly if they are in a place that is predominantly white, versus a context where, if they're in New York, for instance, where they may have more exposure to different languages and cultures. That also was one of the elements that I was interested in. And so that's how the book was born. The book was born from my working on the ground, as most of my research tends to be born from my authentic engagement with communities and seeing how that resonates with my own ideas about what it means to make literacy more just. And so these students' narratives that I present in the book really focus on demonstrating what happened when they were in the Caribbean before they migrated. And then as they went through their life trajectories to get to the US as middle school, high school, or university students, what did it look like for that transition to occur? And what does that mean for literacy teachers, language teachers, who are thinking of Black immigrants? And we're not saying that every child who is a Black immigrant necessarily has the experiences of the two students that I present, but it opens up a conversation for teachers to say, oh, here are the ways in which I can address this particular Black immigrant student. And because of that, I now have this vantage point, this lens that allows me to see other Black immigrant or international students in ways that are very different. And so you had this nexus of practitioner-oriented approaches that I was trying to engage with around literacy, but also the idea of wanting students to be seen, to be heard, their silenced invisibilities to be a marked part of this work. And so I would say that the book then is a book based on what I call the Black immigrant literacies framework, the Black immigrant literacies framework being a framework that I proposed back in 2020, really demonstrating how individuals who are Black immigrants have to learn how to address the myth of the model minority, which positions them as better often than their African-American peers when they get to the US. The framework also talks about the struggle for justice that Black immigrant students either decide to overlook or to join when they get here. And it allows for Black immigrant students to process, what does that mean when I decide to join the struggle or when I decide not to be part of it? How do I position myself within the broader context of what it means to be racialized as Black? And how does that position me in relation to both Black and white, as well as other brown and indigenous peers? A third element of the framework is the transracial linguistic approach, which I would argue is perhaps the most critical part of the framework, really allowing Black immigrants in schools, universities to see sort of how what I call three M's, metalinguistic, metacultural, and metaracial understanding, come together to allow Black immigrant students to demonstrate assets. And what does that mean? It really means that Black immigrant students in my book were reflecting that they were always thinking about how they thought about language. They were always thinking about how they thought about race. They were always thinking about how they thought about culture. And as they made moves with literacy and communicating and engaging semiotically more broadly with the world, they were always making efforts to demonstrate that they had these assets. But because a lot of them did not necessarily, and this was a broader group of students, did not necessarily know that they had these assets, they were not always leveraging them in ways that would allow them to demonstrate their full personhoods in the world. The two students that I focused on from the broader group of students in my research, these two students in my book did recognize the assets that they had. And that's why I chose them for this particular book, because I felt that they could demonstrate to teachers what it means to know that you have these metalinguistic, metacultural, and metaracial assets. But they also were very aware of how they were positioned in relation to white peers, in relation to Black American peers. They talked a lot about how they navigated this, not always fully with the capacity to use their relational experiences to the best of their ability, but they had opportunities to see through their three M's how they were navigating the world. And I argue with this book that teachers, universities, schools have the opportunity to engage all students in using the three M's as a pathway to building reconciliatory bridges between students racialized as Black, Brown, Indigenous, and otherwise, and students who are from what we think of in the US as the dominant group of populations racialized as white.
So my next question is kind of a sub question, kind of building on what you've been talking about. How can Black immigrant literacies capture a global portrait of Black literacy?
It's interesting that you asked this question because I'm literally just completing an article that is based on Black Englishes as a global multilingual imperative. I argue in this piece for a transnational ethos and really thinking about how Black Englishes can get us to think more globally. That is at the crux of the book. The book is sort of saying that Englishes, when we think about Englishes and the ways in which Black immigrants use Englishes, it helps us to think beyond what has for a very long time been sort of an American-based literacy, an American-based literacy that is defined by this nationalistic orientation to literacy practice, but also the idea that there is one type of English, not just an American English, but a specific type of American English that itself becomes the privileged English to which we should all subscribe, or to which we should all try to approximate, for which we should all try to approximate language use. And so I think that by creating or putting this book out into the world where race, language, and immigration are invited to be at the center and not on the periphery of what it means to language and to do literacy, what I am saying to my peers and what I am inviting stakeholders and policymakers to do is to shift the norms, from a monolingual norm that is oriented towards a Eurocentric way of using language that is itself based on how the white European subject defined it centuries ago, shift the norm from a monocultural norm that says this type of way of being in the world, not loud, not too colorful, not too, out there, is the way to be. And there's so many cultural norms that we have that are monocultural norms. And so I'm asking us to shift that to a multicultural norm as part of how we teach literacy, such that the standards that we use to design literacy instruction orient themselves to these multiple norms that are globally based, what I call, transnational nativity. And then the third part is the multiracial, the shifting from the monoracial to the mono to the multiracial norm. This idea that multiple races of people are legitimately situated to utilize, whether it is Englishes or other language practices, as a basis for their literacy capacities and literacy repertoires. And so I think that Black immigrant literacies, it's a bold move. You know, I have worked with so many reverend literacy professors in my brief time in the academy. And then what I realized is that this traditional idea around literacy practice has been intentional. It has been designed in this way. It is not something that is accidental. And so if we designed it intentionally to be monocultural, monolingual, and monoracial, even while saying that we do like the diversities that are present, then we've got to flip the script and make the global elements that are increasingly becoming part of every child's transnational nativity part of the center of what literacy instruction can and should be.
We've sort of touched on it a little bit, but I'd like to sort of ask you a little bit more. Much of your work has been on the diversity of Englishes, different types of Englishes, different uses of Englishes. I can imagine a lot of people listening might not be aware that there are a diversity of Englishes across different groups, across different countries, places. Can you talk about what you mean when you talk about different types of Englishes? Thank you.
My work on Englishes derives from Braj Kashrou's esteemed scholar. He worked for a while at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and did quite a lot of work on Englishes. And so that is where that term Englishes comes from, at least in my research. Braj Kashrou described Englishes and how they operated across the globe and put them into three concentric, into three circles, the inner circle, outer circle, and expanding circle Englishes is what he called them. And so the idea was that with inner circle Englishes, you had Englishes that were predominantly spoken in Anglo-Saxon countries, such as the US and Australia and Canada. With the outer circle Englishes, you had folks who were or had been colonized by Britain, and those were the ones who were designed as using outer circle Englishes, such as Bangladesh, India, many of those in the Caribbean. And then the expanding circle Englishes, you had Englishes that represented those learned as foreign languages in countries such as China, Indonesia, and Nepal. And so that was Braj Kashrou's way of thinking about Englishes based on national identity. The idea that depending on where you were based geographically, you had these opportunities to leverage Englishes based on these three circles. And I was very interested in the three circle model of Englishes because I came from a St. Lucian context. I worked in the Trinidad and Tobago in the Caribbean, and I had seen Englishes being used all the time as a child. I was very fascinated by the fact that I could speak the Queen's English. You know, I was always very interested in sounding proper, and you know, my students, I wanted them to sound the same way as well. I still remember one of my drama-oriented classes that I was doing with students, and I wanted them to speak so well. I thought that was the way they should sound. They should sound proper. And so being part of that outer circle Englishes context in the Caribbean, I think, allowed me to have a very clear understanding of how I positioned Englishes as a teacher back then, but also when I got to the US, how my Englishes that I had positioned as so great and proper and good were not accepted necessarily in the US context. They was looked upon as, oh, how she sounds so, right? In Trinidad, that's how we say, how she sounds so, you know? And so why would I sound this in this particular way and how illegitimate I sounded? In fact, I silenced myself a lot when I got to the US. I saw students doing that as well, silencing themselves as immigrants from the Caribbean because the illegitimacy was just too much. I saw professors in my research talking about just how this presented such a challenge for them. They thought they had been speaking English all along, but clearly something was not right here, right? And so you had this idea of English is really morphing into not just a national identity-based English is for me, but thinking about how do these Englishes cross circles? And I call it cross-circle Englishes. They cross circles based on language, race, and immigration to create new ways of thinking about what Englishes do across these circles. I go back to transnational nativity, which is the idea that every person, no matter where they are right now in this moment, has access to so many global Englishes online, which means that they are no longer thinking from a local nativity perspective. They are thinking by default, many of them, not all, but most people engaged in the online world would be functioning from that transnational nativity space. And so with that, I proposed the idea of cross-circle Englishes, extending the research of this renowned scholar, Braj Kashrum, and joining conversations around global Englishes, translingual Englishes that had already been in motion, and saying, let's look at how racialization and immigration, you know, necessarily position Englishes in ways that are different from just nativity or national identity based on geographical location. And so for my research, the Englishes that I look at really have been primarily Caribbean Englishes, which were, of course, designated as part of the outer circle, but which I now refer to as cross-circle Englishes because they operate by many Caribbean speakers across the globe in ways that are very different depending on how these Caribbean speakers are engaging with you know, different elements of race, class, gender, and identity.
And if I could just follow up, could you talk a bit more about how, so you've talked about how folks moving from places like the Caribbean to the US and elsewhere, they felt they were speaking what they call the Queen's English or proper English, as you said, and that was not received as such when they arrived. What were sort of the markers, I guess, if you can talk about that make that English not proper, as it were? Is it accent? Is it phrasing? Is it cultural references? Or, I mean, I suspect it's hard to generalize across the different types of Englishes, but I'd just be interested to know a bit more, like what is sort of the what marks it out, the various types of English as different in the eyes of people in say the US or other Anglo-Saxon countries? Thank you.
Yes. So a very good question. I would say that there are multiple pieces that have come into play with my qualitative research here, sort of hearing from the experiences of Black immigrant youth, Black immigrant students who are younger, Black immigrant educators and teachers who are older. And so looking across a range of populations who are Black immigrant in nature, quite a number of pieces came to bear. I think though that for most of them, what they described was sort of that in the US context, they were seen as Black American before they opened their mouths. And so got a lot of that idea of this is the way they are positioned. And I described this in my 2019 article, how students and educators are positioned, then they are constantly repositioned, as they keep hearing. So they're positioned first as Black American, because, you know, the first lens that many Americans tend to have for them is that they would be Black American. And then when they open their mouths, they are repositioned, right? So they are then thought to be from another place. And because they are from another place, what they describe, these participants, is that there is a sort of delegitimacy that begins. So after they are believed to not be American, then the delegitimacy begins at the place where they are thought to be from another country. And it's not that someone is saying that they are illegitimate, it is that they are responding in different kinds of ways. And so they might ask questions such as, well, what do you all speak in the Caribbean? I don't understand why you all could speak English that well if you all come from the Caribbean. Things of that nature where individuals would make it very clear what their basis is for judging or for using what we refer to in the research based on Nelson Flores and Jonathan's work, the white listening subject, which was defined by the European speaker centuries ago as the way to sort of determine who they are. And then, of course, you had things such as, yes, the accent playing a role where certain speakers, depending on how they accentuated their Englishes, the level of approximation to words, what many thought of as mainstream American, would be a surprise, but it would also be more legitimate. For instance, I count myself as complicit in this. You know, I talk about in many ways how my Englishes and my versatility with Englishes gives me a privilege in the US Academy that many other Caribbean speakers may not necessarily have, because I can go back and forth very easily between my vernacular Englishes, what many think of as my vernacular Englishes from St. Lucia or from Trinidad and Tobago. And I can speak very, very differently from how I am speaking on this podcast. But at the same time, I can do the speaking that we think of as very much appropriating a lot of these white mainstream American English norms. And so you have this sort of variation in terms of how participants describe the progression of what I call delegitimacy in my article titled, How Does a Black Person Speak English Beyond American Language Norms? So delegitimacy proceeds for different individuals based on sort of how they sound, based on their accent, but also the vocabulary they used. In that article in the American Educational Research Journal, I talk about how the vocabulary that they were using, for instance, one of my participants was using the word damn, and he used the word in a classroom context, and everybody sort of freaked out and couldn't understand why would he use a word like this in a space like this, when for him, this was perfectly normal as part of the way that he would speak in the Caribbean context. So you had vocabulary, you also had ways of being semiotically, right? Where I believe that in the research that I saw, some of my participants were very kinetic. And so they, you know, the semiotics, bodily semiotics were very different from how an American might present the self, at least what many think of as an acceptable American way of being in a classroom or in a public space. And so you had a broader semiotics playing a role, which I've begun to explore a bit more in my research, looking at how these broader semiotics come to affect how individuals view Caribbean populations as legitimate or not. And so I think it's multiple factors, but it doesn't necessarily mean that every individual has the same number of factors. It also doesn't necessarily mean that every individual makes the same kinds of moves. Like I had some participants who decided that they were going to talk how they spoke. So one of my African participants decided that he was not going to change how he sounded with his Ghanaian accent because all of his students understood him. And therefore, why couldn't all of these people understand him? And he realized that the delegitimacy for them was not that he couldn't speak English. It was that he was racialized as Black speaking that kind of way. And so that was where the delegitimacy happened. And so the racial part of the delegitimacy became very interesting to me because you had some of my participants operating with what I call sound white gaze, using part of that term coming from Toni Morrison's work, sound white gaze, meaning that this participant who decided not to change his Ghanaian way of using Englishes was operating without attention to the white gaze and literally just living his authentic self in the world. And I was very fascinated by that because some of my students were also doing it as well, though not all of them. and really trying to grapple with how does this delegitimacy happen for each individual? And how could we create perhaps a model of what it looks like for delegitimacy to be something that individuals grapple with, but that institutions also play a role in reducing these levels of delegitimacy that they impose on Black immigrant populations.
So when thinking about literacy and language education in the United States, how do the experiences of Black immigrant students differ from those of Black American students? Thank you.
So I would say that a lot of my research has focused on looking at either quantitative or qualitative approaches to what it means for Black immigrant populations to engage with language and literacy. And in some of these studies, I have focused also on Black American students. And I define these students knowing fully well that there is some conflation between what we think of as a Black immigrant and a Black American. We know now that there are many Black American students who have, parents who may have been immigrants. There are many Black immigrant students who may not always want to identify as immigrant, and therefore they use what we tend to think of as a Black American persona, and they erase their immigration personas as they engage with the world. And so I just want to put that out there as part of the nuance that I'm always paying attention to as I discuss these dynamics. But really and truly, the research has shown clearly that there is a tendency to think of Black American students as being underperforming in relation to Black immigrant students. And this tendency has caused us to overlook the impact of Eurocentric structures in literacy practice on all students racialized as Black. I say this because in my research quantitatively, I have seen, while looking at reading literacy from the Program for International Student Assessment Achievement data, which is OECD designated and quite a highly regarded form of data for so many countries across the world, that assessment, by looking at reading literacy, looking at math literacy, looking at science literacy over multiple years or iterations of that assessment being administered to Black Americans and to Black immigrant students, we found, the researchers with whom I worked, we found that clearly, even though Black immigrant students are not performing better than their African American peers, they are not themselves meeting the average norm that the OECD has set for reading literacy or for literacy on these assessments. What does that really mean? It means that we've said for so long that Black immigrant students are performing better than African immigrant students, but when we look at such a major test that the OECD uses and that nations use to make so many decisions, this test itself shows that both Black immigrants and Black American students are underperforming. And I use the word underperforming in quotation marks because I do not believe that these tests are designed to necessarily allow students to demonstrate their assets, no matter who they are. I believe that these tests are designed in ways that allow certain students to reflect what they can do, and then other students to be subjugated. And so as I continue to work through the qualitative elements of this, or before even I get to the qualitative elements, I think that one of the things I looked at was how are Black American and Black immigrant students identifying as English speakers on these assessments? And clearly, when you go into the PISA data sets, you can see that they're being asked to mark, do you speak English or not? So it's a dichotomy of, do I speak English or not? But then what kinds of Englishes do you speak? Because if I'm going to compare you as a Black immigrant or Black American student to another student who may be monolingual or who may be mainstream English speaking American, if you possess multiple Englishes and you have variations in how you use these Englishes, your capacity for leveraging these Englishes is going to be very different from a student who, let's say, is mainstream American English speaking and does not have a versatility with multiple Englishes as you do as a Black immigrant or Black American child. And so being able to see how Black American and Black immigrant students identify as English speakers on this assessment measure, despite having so much versatility in their linguistic repertoires, tells me or told us as a group of researchers that there is something missing here in terms of how PISA is designating how individuals identify as English speakers. So you have millions of students identifying as English speakers who are themselves multiple speakers of Englishes and navigate these Englishes across a range of what we think of as proficiency tends to be itself based on European or Eurocentric norms. And so you have a conundrum then between how do you get to help these students identify as English speakers and how do you get those who are Black American to demonstrate their versatility in ways that are very different from those who are Black immigrants. The qualitative research that I did with Black immigrants and Black American students revealed that the cultural foundation for the Englishes that these students possess is very different. We know that language is culture, language and culture are inextricable, inextricably linked, meaning that they cannot be separated. So if you have a Black immigrant student who has Englishes that they're using in literacy classrooms, the cultural foundation for their Englishes is going to be very different from what many might think of as a Black American child who has not had a cultural foundation outside of the U.S. or who doesn't have parents, perhaps, who were born and raised outside of the U.S. And so that was one of the key pieces qualitatively that I kept seeing, sort of the ways in which English had developed as a repertoire in the life of a Black immigrant child. Very different from how it had been developed in the life of a Black American student. And so you had that cultural foundation. You also had individuals being able to demonstrate that their assessment capacities for using Englishes were not always necessarily mapped on to the ways in which the assessment capacities for, let's say, a Black immigrant student necessarily played out. And so you have multiple pathways, I think, to thinking about what Black immigrants and Black American students can do. But at the same time, I'm also wary of overlooking the conflation between these two groups because there can be mechanisms for Black immigrant children to also be Black American and vice versa.
So what needs to be done so that Eurocentric systems of education and academia can carry the burden that Black immigrant and Black American speakers bear in adjusting to white language norms that privilege one standard English over others?
So I, in thinking about this question, I'm immediately brought to the point of the fact that Black American and Black immigrant speakers are already flipping the script, are already really changing what we know to be the ways that Englishes are functioning across the globe. We have Black speakers everywhere doing this. Black speakers beyond America, beyond the Caribbean, Black speakers in Africa, in Europe. And so I would have to say that given that the script is already being flipped, it tells us that already Eurocentric mechanisms for trying to determine what people racialized as Black can do with Englishes, the paradigm has already changed. We are not necessarily as schools and universities and society willing to accept that it has changed because I think we keep lamenting why are so many students in our schools unable to use what we think of as standard English. They can't write well. They can't punctuate well. So we keep trying to go back to a norm that has shifted. Why can't our students who have graduated from high schools get a proper job and be able to write a proper email, for instance? Why do we have to now lower the bar? Because we can't get so many students who have graduated out of colleges to get a proper job because they cannot do the things they need to do with Englishes. So we have already seen a paradigm shift. We've already seen something change in terms of how Englishes are now requiring the burden for that norm to be shifted, to remove itself from imposing this kind of requirement on Black and Brown and Indigenous speakers. But we have not accepted the shift. And so I think what I would say is that the academy, schools, universities, there is no other way. We will eventually have to move the bar. We will eventually have to change the norms because they are already shifting. And the generation that's coming up is through the pipeline. The generations that are going to come after our generation, they are going to require a different set of norms. And so I think what I've asked, you know, our colleagues, our stakeholders, our policymakers to do is to be thinking about how do the current standards that we have allow for that multicultural, multiracial, multilingual norm. In the absence of that, I think we are facing U.S. citizens or anyone who lives in the U.S. context where there is sort of this dominant white listening subject norm, we're placing them at a disadvantage because they are unable by default now to engage with a global mechanism for operating based on transnational nativity. And therefore, because of that, we are limiting the capacity of U.S. citizens to be able to engage meaningfully with the rest of the world in the absence of this shift towards a multilingual, multicultural, multiracial norm. And this is the crux of the book, Black Immigrant Literacies. It is also extended in my book, Literacies of Migration, coming out with Cambridge University Press, requires sort of this engagement with what I call linguistic innocence and Black innocence of our speakers who can function sound white gaze. And I ask in my book that not only do our Black speakers need to be able to have opportunities by schools and institutions to function sound white gaze, but white students need to be able to do this as well. They need to be able to function without that norm that a lot of their ancestors have allowed them to think is the better norm to be the way of being in the world. And so it liberates both populations racialized as white, it liberates populations racialized as Black and Brown, and it allows for that reconciliatory opportunity for individuals to engage together. And so there isn't just a fix-it mechanism that can happen in this moment. I think that the world itself veers towards justice. And the justice that we're already seeing is that the script is already being flipped, and that we have several organizations, schools, universities, who are themselves starting to develop policies, develop mechanisms that allow for these Englishes to shine through.
Thank you so much for that. Well, just before we finish, I just wanted to give you the opportunity to mention any upcoming research projects you're working on that you think would be of interest to our listeners. Thank you.
So I think I probably would like to end on this note about my recent embarking on this grant project with a couple of colleagues addressing Black suicide prevention and bringing this idea of race, language, and immigration to that conversation. We know now that so many of our Black youth are in jeopardy across the United States. Suicide is at an alarming rate, is occurring at an alarming rate. And being able to bring this idea of race, language, and immigration to that conversation, I think is critical as we are continuing to have so many more Black immigrants operating in our spheres. We are also projecting that by 2060, there will be a lot more Black immigrants than there are already. And so with this new research project, really thinking about how we can engage in preventative measures through Englishes, through language practices, which at their very core design the personhoods of so many children, is very important to me. And I'm very much looking forward to seeing how students respond in this conversation and how families respond. I've just been elected as Vice President of the Literacy Research Association, and being able to have some of those transnational conversations around what literacy means is also one of the pathways that I think can allow us to expand our reach in terms of what we think of as literacy practice beyond English, but also towards Englishes and towards other named languages.
Thank you so much. And just to say, listeners can find links to all the materials mentioned in our show notes. Professor Patrianne Smith, thank you so much for speaking to the Ballpark today.
Thank you.
Patrianne Smith is a professor in the College of Education at the University of South Florida. And that's it for this episode of the Ballpark. Thanks to Patrianne Smith for joining us in this episode. For more information about the Phelan U.S. Center, you can go to www.lse.ac.uk/United-States. On Twitter and Instagram, we're at @LSE_US, and on Facebook, we're LSE United States. This episode of The Ballpark was produced by Chris Gilson and Anderson Tan. Our theme tune is by Ranger and the Rearrangers, a Seattle-based gypsy jazz band. Look them up at rangerswings.com. To listen to all our previous episodes, just enter LSE Ballpark into your search engine of choice. You'll find us. We're free to listen to, and unlike lots of other podcasts, we're ad-free. We'd love to hear what you think about the show. Email us any feedback at uscenter@lse.ac.uk, or you can send us a tweet at @LSE_US and tell your friends about us. If you like what you've heard, then please rate and review us via your podcast platform. It helps other people find the show. The content and opinions expressed in this podcast do not reflect those of the Phelan U.S. Center or the London School of Economics. Thanks for listening.